It is Thursday, September 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, rescuers scramble to find earthquake survivors in Mexico. U.S. President Donald Trump imposes new sanctions against North Korea.
For much too long, North Korea has been allowed to abuse the international financial system to facilitate funding for its nuclear weapons and missile programs.
And a new play brings serious heartbreak to American kitchens. It's all ahead. Rescue teams in Mexico worked Thursday to reach those still trapped among the dozens of buildings that fell during a massive earthquake that's killed more than 230 people. One search in Mexico City took place at a school where on Wednesday, workers spotted a girl buried in the debris and were able to confirm she was still alive by asking her to move her hand. VOA Celia Mendoza is on the scene in Mexico City.
We have several locations where they are trying to rescue adults and children. Right now, I am in the south part of Mexico City. This earthquake was very particular because it didn't concentrate in one area. It actually traveled from north to south, affecting several areas throughout the city, which has made the efforts a little bit more complicated because the resources have been distributed in this city, which is a very large city. Right now, we are at the Enrique Rebsamen, which is the school, elementary and secondary children, and they were 400. They were registered in two buildings. One of them collapsed completely, and as I'm speaking now, I have to keep my voice lower because they are undergoing different efforts to try to get them out, and one of the requisites that they have for us is that we have to be quiet when they're doing that. So that is one of the reasons most media and anybody that is here have to follow every direction that is being given because it interferes with the efforts. The little girl that has been there, a 12-year-old, has become famous worldwide after she allegedly contacted her mom using her cell phone through WhatsApp. And that way they were able to identify where she was. They also said that they have at least 3 to 4 children more that are in that particular school. And it has become a race against time, as rescuers tell me, that the oxygen is running out.
Apparently, they've been able to get, I believe, some water or some oxygen to her.
That's right. They were able to mobilize some water through a hose. They were trying to get oxygen, and that's a part of the effort. Yesterday, they have another aftershock, and aftershocks made the advancement that they made on the way through her go back. Yesterday, they had to stop some of the efforts after a big aftershock in Oaxaca, like an hour ago from Mexico City, 4.6. Aftershock that moved the building, which is already very damaged, and made some of the platforms where the floors were on the building, and they were able to come out. So then one of the reasons that they have to try to get her now is because those platforms are falling down even more on top of her.
Yes, this must really be a race against time, not only for her, but for some of the other children as well.
That's correct. And the world has focused on her because she has become just an image of it. But we have to remember that there's many more people that are in this situation, adults as well. Yesterday, I was witness of two rescues in the northern part of the city, in Colonia Roma, where two women were rescued from an office building. And we have seen family members just there staying overnight waiting for their family members. We spoke to one of those members of a family who says that he's not leaving until his family member gets out alive. And that is definitely something that authorities are trying to do. However, in some locations that have been disputed because there are going to use heavy machinery to start move the rubble, and that could mean that those people that are alive could be lose that opportunity to come out without any problem.
That's VOA's Celia Mendoza, who is in Mexico City. Time now for social media. Today is International Day of Peace. The United Nations General Assembly has declared it a day of peace for all nations, and it's been in existence since 1981. Under hashtag Peace Day, a number of Twitter users have commented. The United Nations tweets on hashtag Peace Day, at UN_women, is celebrating ambitious and dedicated women worldwide for their commitment to peace. The organization World Vision tweets, "If we have no peace, it is because we have forgotten that we belong to each other." That's a quote by Mother Teresa. Peace Day 365 tweets, "An eye for an eye will only make the whole world blind." Those are the words of Mahatma Gandhi. And a Twitter handle for the late Beatle George Harrison says, "Give me love, give me love, give me peace on earth." Another site for today, kind of regretfully, is hashtag Last Day of Summer. One Twitter user tweeted, "Waving goodbye to summer today. Enjoy soaking up the last of summer sunshine." And that tweet was accompanied by a picture of Charlie Brown and the dog Snoopy. Another user quotes the late blind and deaf activist Helen Keller, who said, "Keep your face to the sunshine and you cannot see the shadows. It's what the sunflowers do." And that's also shown next to a picture of some sunflowers. Dana Fulton tweets, "And there it goes. Wave goodbye to hashtag summer today, everyone. Anyone else ready for fall? Hashtag last day of summer." Here are some of the top news stories that we're following. Iraq launches an offensive to recapture Hawija. Hurricane Maria knocks out power and floods Puerto Rico. The president of Liberia is confident in her country's future, and Kenya pushes for rerun elections back to October 26. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Sleep deprivation has been linked to a number of negative health effects, including high risks of heart disease, kidney disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, stroke, and even obesity. But back in the 1990s, researchers found that total sleep deprivation, which is defined as about 36 hours of forced wakefulness, also provided clinical improvement in symptoms of depression. A new report, based on an analysis of more than 2,000 studies by researchers at the University of Pennsylvania, found that partial sleep deprivation also quickly reduced the symptoms of depression in 40 to 60% of those observed in the studies. The researchers defined partial sleep deprivation as 3 to 4 hours of sleep, followed by being kept awake for 20 to 21 hours. Depression is commonly treated with antidepressant medication and/or psychotherapy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new play reflects on Syria's civil war. U.S. President Donald Trump said Thursday he's imposing new sanctions against North Korea for its nuclear threat as he prepared for meetings with the leaders of South Korea and Japan to plot strategy on their confrontation with Pyongyang.
"For much too long, North Korea has been allowed to abuse the international financial system to facilitate funding for its nuclear weapons and missile programs. The United States has had representatives working on this problem for over 25 years. They have done nothing. That's why we're in the problem that we're in today, in addition to, frankly, other countries not doing what they should have done. Tolerance for this disgraceful practice must end now. Our new order will give the Treasury Department the discretion to sanction any foreign bank that knowingly conducts or facilitate significant transactions tied to trade with North Korea.
Trump met separately with South Korean President Moon Jae-in and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, and together with both of them at a working lunch in New York on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly. The meetings focused on their so far futile attempts to rein in North Korean leader Kim Jong-un from carrying out repeated nuclear weapons and ballistic missile tests. It was not immediately clear how they would differ from the latest round of penalties imposed by the United Nations Security Council targeting North Korean exports and energy supplies. Well, President Trump said Wednesday he's decided whether the Iranian nuclear agreement continues to serve U.S. security interests. Mr. Trump did not reveal what that decision is. It comes ahead of his requirement to inform Congress by October 15th whether Tehran remains in compliance. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson indicated late Wednesday in a meeting with the signatories to the international agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, that Iran is in compliance 2 years after it was reached.
We clearly have significant issues with the agreement. The president's been quite clear and articulate as to his concerns about the agreement itself. From a technical standpoint, the IAEA reports continue to indicate and confirm that Iran is in technical compliance of the agreement, and no one around the table took exception to that.
Mr. Trump has been critical of the agreement, but Iranian President Hassan Rouhani told a New York news conference he did not believe the U.S. would walk away from it. He said Iran would not be the first to violate the JCPOA, which temporarily restricts its nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. University of Pennsylvania political science professor Ian Lustig told International Edition's Victor Beatty, Mr. Trump is playing a dangerous political game.
If he does nothing, that is, if he does not certify that the Iranians are in compliance, which they obviously are, but if he does not assert that they are, which he's been doing every 3 months, then the Congress has 60 days to decide whether it's going to reimpose sanctions and in that way break the agreement. Now, he could also decide within that 60 days, no, I've decided I'm going to certify. So we don't really know. All we know is that he is creating an unnecessary crisis. He is responding to vociferous voices that still exist, although they're a minority, that the treaty with Iran is not in American interests. He is doing something which presidents don't usually do, which is to not absorb any of the uncertainty into his presidency that has to do with whether this deal should go forward, instead to try to thrust it all on the Congress. He's playing a little bit of a political game. It's kind of a political game that he seems to play with everything that comes his way. When you do it in foreign policy on an issue like Iran, you're taking big chances.
Vice President Pence told the UN Security Council that Iran continues to flout the spirit of the Iran deal, destabilizing the region, brazenly threatening the security of sovereign nations. Does that give you a hint, perhaps?
If you would ask the other powers, our allies and our opponents, China or Russia, but also Germany, Britain, France, who signed the agreement with us, if anybody's flouting the spirit of the agreement, it's the United States. According to the agreement, the United States is bound to actively protect Iran's rights as long as it is in compliance. Instead, the discussion in the United States has been how to find ways to enforce the agreement that are so strict and irritating that the Iranians will withdraw. What we have with North Korea is what we would have with Iran if we didn't have the agreement. Do we really want two of these situations? You've got hardliners in Iran who have been arguing all along what hardliners in the United States have been arguing, that this agreement is purely in America's interest, that Iran should never have signed it, and that Iran should take advantage of American behavior and pull out of the agreement and go for a nuclear posture just like North Korea has, because, look, the United States doesn't attack North Korea. It would certainly not attack Iran, since Iran is much stronger than North Korea.
That's Ian Lustig of the University of Pennsylvania. General John Hyten, the head of the U.S. Strategic Command, said in Washington Wednesday that Iran is operating within the nuclear agreement, but also rapidly deploying and developing a series of ballistic missiles of all ranges, posing a challenge to the U.S. and its allies. Ian Lustig said there is no doubt Tehran wants to be the dominant power in the region, and while the U.S. would prefer it not to engage in missile development, the agreement does not require them to abandon it. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. House concerts are growing in popularity in the United States. A musical group or performance artist puts on a show in someone's home for a small, paying audience. Well, a play in New York picks up on that theme, not in someone's living room, but in their kitchen, using the appliances, a chopping board, and a very big knife. In Oh My Sweet Land, audiences watch an actress prepare a typical Syrian dish and tell stories about the country's ongoing six-year-long civil war. Jeff London reports.
The kitchen I went to in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn, was clean and organized. Baskets of lemons, rows of cooking oil. As music played on the radio, a woman with long curly hair puttered around the kitchen, putting a package of meat in the fridge, sautéing pine nuts. Then she began to speak.
Since I came back, I make kubbe. Again and again. As if I want to close a hole in my soul.
I had to guarantee that the audience tears up, so there's a lot of onion cutting.
That's Amir Nazir Zouabi, the playwright and director of Oh My Sweet Land. A Palestinian, he got the idea for the play several years ago when he traveled to Syrian refugee camps in Jordan. He adapted several of the stories he heard, and since food and hospitality are a cornerstone of Arab culture, he included cooking.
I didn't want to do a horror show. But it's important to remember that this is an attack on a culture. Not just the political situation, it's an attack on the way of life. And the loss in Syria is also this. It's the loss of normality, of just the ability to break bread together and meat.
I remember my father standing at the window shouting, "Fadalu!" to strangers when they walked by. "Come in, eat!" People looking at the strange man holding a plate of food at the window, inviting passersby in for coffee or food. Fadalu, fadalu.
I've never done anything so difficult before.
Actress Nadine Malouf not only tells the harrowing story of a woman who follows her Syrian lover to the Middle East, but cooks kubba while she tells it.
I have nicked myself a few times. I've burnt myself with oil. I've, you know, wounds, war wounds.
The Australian actress of Middle Eastern and European descent says it's a challenge to deal with the emotions of the story while cooking.
It's a little bit like, you know, rubbing your belly and tapping your head at the same time.
All around us, Syrians argue loudly about politics.
As the kitchen gets messier, so does the story.
We arrive in Tafas. Some of the buildings have been so heavily shelled, they
They seem to defy gravity. They look like lace, like concrete lingerie.
Watching the play in this setting becomes almost painfully intimate for both the audience and the actor.
You tell immediately, you know, like, who doesn't want you to look at them? You feel everyone. And I understand that because there's, you know, a safety in the audience being in the dark and the actors on the stage. And that's very safe for both parties. Here, no one is safe.
After the show, audience members milled outside on the sidewalk to chat and enjoy some baklava. Among them was Michael Yuen Killick, who owns the house. He had to clean out his kitchen and dining room for the event. I asked him why he opened his personal space to 20 strangers.
It's a fantastic opportunity. I mean, how often do you get to have a show performed in your house? Not very often.
One of those strangers, Allison Martin, a nurse practitioner, called the experience incredibly visceral.
Being in the small space and smell the onions midway through really brings the far away to right here in front of us.
And that's the point of Oh My Sweet Land. The onions, spices, and stories linger long after the final bow. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Thanks very much, Jeff, and that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Working with their partners in the global coalition to defeat ISIS, Iraq's security forces have made significant progress in the mission to liberate all of the territory ISIS once held in Iraq. Speaking recently in Erbil, Iraq, Special Presidential Envoy for the coalition, Brett McGurk, called the historic cooperation between the Iraqi security forces and the Kurdish Peshmerga essential to the recent victories against ISIS, also known as Daesh. Mr. McGurk took note of the cost of the fight on our heroic partners who have sacrificed so much in this fight. The Peshmerga have suffered almost 2,000 martyrs in this overall campaign, and the Iraqi forces have probably suffered five times more, he said. The sacrifice from the Kurdish Peshmerga is something that we, the United States and the entire world, really honor. We extend our condolences to the martyrs and to the families, and similar condolences to all those lost on the side of Iraqi security forces. Special Envoy McGurk emphasized that the battle against ISIS is not over and pointed to the upcoming fight in the northern city of Hawija, where it is estimated that some hundreds of ISIS fighters remain in control of the city. He urged continued cooperation between the Peshmerga and the Iraqi security forces so that ISIS's hold on Hawija is rooted out in a smart way. Mr. McGurk noted the political disagreements between the Kurdish leaders and the government in Baghdad, including over a proposed independence referendum later this month by the Kurdish regional government. The United States does not support the referendum. In a press statement, the White House said, "Holding the referendum in disputed areas is particularly provocative and destabilizing. We therefore call on the Kurdistan regional government to call off the referendum and enter into serious and sustained dialogue with Baghdad, which the United States has repeatedly indicated it is prepared to facilitate." The White House noted that the referendum is distracting from the efforts to defeat ISIS and stabilize the liberated areas. Special Envoy McGurk pointed out that the Iraqi security forces and the Peshmerga have fought as brothers against their common enemy. "It's very important that we remain united and focused on the efforts to defeat Daesh and ensure that they have a lasting defeat. This war is not over, and that's a critical message for everybody."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.